I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio, and happy Independence Day for all of our American listeners out there. We are having a special Independence Day podcast today, our normal live stream, but we are going to be mixing it up a little bit. In the first hour, my guests will be Millennial Woes, who's one of my regular panelists, of course, and we'll also have Gregory Hood, who
Good
writes
to be here,
a lot.
Guys.
Yeah, welcome, Greg Hood. And Woes, you want to hop on and say hi?
Hello, everyone. And thank you for inviting me on again.
Well, we are going to be celebrating Independence Day in the United States today, but it's sort of a, how to put it, a somewhat diminished occasion because America is a mess right now. And I thought I would have Greg Hood come on because he's written some very good pieces about the flag controversy. He's written about Independence Day. And if you would like to ask him questions or share comments with him, there is one way that you can do that and wrap it with a little tip, and that is to go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. Entropy is the only site on the web that allows people to send us money via credit cards. We have upset a lot of people, and we have been blacklisted because of this from the global credit card processing industry. But you can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, all one word. Hit the green button. We are not streaming through Entropy, but you can still leave an offline chat, and we will get to that in the course of today's show. And if you have questions specifically for Greg Hood, try and get them in for the first hour. And in the second hour, we will be having Jim Goad on. So I want to begin with a question that comes from one of our longtime readers and supporters. His name is Sutton. Is July the 4th Independence Day for white Americans or for all Americans? So, Greg, do you want to comment on that?
Well, until recently, I think that would obviously be pretty self-evident that it was for all Americans. However, it's not whites who have decided that it's no longer for all Americans, but it's blacks, and I guess more accurately, the leading voices in academia and the media. I mean, the whole undercurrent of Juneteenth is that this is going to be the second Independence Day, perhaps the real Independence Day, the more dominant Independence Day, because at this point, who in America really derives a sense of passionate national identity from the fact that we're separated from the British or that we fought a war for freedom from some colonial power? Because in a way, that almost attacks the premise of white privilege, because whites can never be we can never be like the people who fight an anti-colonial rebellion, right? By definition, we have to always be in the colonial position. And so I just don't think what specifically July 4th celebrates is very meaningful to those who hold cultural power today. And I think we've seen an increasing effort over the past few years to say that traditional American symbols, particularly the flag, particularly the established national holidays, not just Independence Day, obviously, but things like Columbus Day, really are just for white Americans. And this is, of course, pretty suicidal, considering that the main focus of the American government right now seems to be give as many privileges and preferences to white, to non-whites as possible, while treating whites to lectures about how shameful their history is and how they need to pay for everything. And of course, the bigger thing that's the undercurrent of all of this, and the thing that makes me wonder whether this is really sustainable, is you simultaneously, I mean, the New York Times just today, I believe, you simultaneously have this push saying basic national symbols like the flag, things you can't get more fundamental about what people in a given territory should have in common. How we can't even expect that. But then in the very next breath, there's also this talk about how we need to stop the insurrection of Trump supporters, how we need to make sure there's no extremism, how we need to make sure that we fight all these wars internationally and make sure that everybody's pumped up to maintain the empire and everything else. And the contradictions are just being piled one upon another. So at this point, I think it's not so much that white advocates or whatever, you know, the far right or whatever scare term people want to use claimed the flag, claimed Independence Day, claimed traditional Americana, and said, no, this just belongs to us. It doesn't belong to you. What we're hearing is the message, we don't want these things. They belong to you because we want nothing to do with them. But somehow we're still in the position of telling you that you're traitors and we're not, even though we hate everything this country was founded on. We hate every traditional symbol of its identity. And we specifically hate the people who started it, the founding fathers.
Yeah, we didn't take the flag away from everybody. In fact, people on the right, patriotic people, let's just say patriots in a broad sense, tend to embrace this very inclusive notion of American identity. It's for everyone. It's not just for every American. It's for the whole world. Everybody wants to be an American, right?
Right. I mean, that's the mainstream right position.
Yeah. And
When you know, Joe Biden said not too long ago, oh, being American is a matter of an idea. Well, that's no different than your, I mean, that's wrong, of course. And that's the most profoundly unconservative thing you can possibly say. But it's also nothing that you're not going to hear at Heritage Foundation or National Review or anywhere else.
Right, right. We didn't take the flag from these people. We didn't take Independence Day from these people. They have thrown it in the trash, basically. And I guess you can say that it's white identitarians who are going to pick it out of the trash and say, yeah, it really is ours. When the people who signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776, they were all white. They were all men. Most of them were Protestant. They were quintessentially WASPy. They went on to pledge their lives, fortune, and sacred honor to the cause of freedom. They created a country after a war that claimed a lot of lives and a lot of hardship. And they created a constitution. And the first thing that they passed in under the new constitution was a naturalization act that made clear that they were creating a polity for European people, basically white people. They created America for white people. It was created by white people, for white people. There were these other people around, unfortunately, and they had to deal with that, the slave population, the savage Indian tribes, and so forth. I think those are mentioned, actually, in the Declaration.
Yeah, that's the Declaration of Independence. I've noticed in recent years when conservatives still try to kind of prop up the cult of civic nationalism. Sometimes they'll even dress up in colonial garb and read the Declaration of Independence, but they'll actually exempt that part about the merciless Indian savages and what they were doing on the frontier, which Jefferson, of course, identified as one of the main reasons America needed to break away.
Exactly, exactly. That's beautiful. I think we're the rightful inheritors of the symbols of the documents, of the ideas, and so forth, that have come down from the founding. We're the only ones who care about this stuff. And people tried on the right to give this the most inclusive, progressive interpretation possible. And that is being basically wadded up and thrown back in their faces. And I think that they need to basically get the message, take the message. People of color reject America. This is not their country in any sense, except you might say that a conquered country, an enslaved country, is their country. They're here to prey on this country. They're here to take from this country. They're not here to contribute to this country. They're not here to lay down their lives for this country.
Well, also, it's not like we have a choice in the matter. I mean, one of the things that's pretty amusing when you read about the way media power is analyzed, when you talk about power relationships, when you talk about who is it that actually controls the system, right-wingers are not, of however broadly you want to define that, call that patriots, call that even including typical Republicans, these people don't have the power to control what the real meaning of a symbol is. The people who have that power are those who control academia, who control the media, and who control the financial institutions that can back these kinds of outlets. As you say, basically, we've been blacklisted by the entire financial establishment. And somehow in the same breath, you'll hear progressives talk about how elites are supporting nationalism or something like that. But I mean, if all you have to do is see how the world functions today to know that's not true based on real evidence. And right now we're in a position where you can't have a normal event without blacks having their own flag, their own national anthem. You can't have a kind of confession of faith where you have America. And this is not just an American issue where you have Americans or Canadians, whoever else, make this weird almost prayer where they say, oh, we acknowledge we are standing on stolen ground, and blah, blah, blah. You have a number of Hispanics trying to conflate their identity with that of American Indians. They have every incentive in the world to do these things because the more outrageous the claims, the more money they will get from the government or from various institutions. And so there's no point where the process stops and they say, okay, we've gone this far. We don't need to go any further. It's just going to get crazier and crazier. And conservatives are basically in this position of saying, but don't you understand you're better off here than you would be anywhere else? Why shouldn't you unite around this thing? Well, maybe that's true, but they're even better off if they reject this frame altogether and keep claiming to be victims, keep talking about all the wrongs the historic nation has done to them, and keep saying that they deserve special treatment. They have every economic and social incentive to keep doing these things. And if you subsidize something, you get more of it. Now, conservatives understand this when it comes to economic policy. God knows there are plenty of conservatives who will go to the mat for some of the most unpopular economic policies possible, opposing the minimum wage, for instance, because they'll say, oh, well, you have to oppose this because otherwise you're creating perverse incentives that'll make everybody worse off. But suddenly when it comes to culture, they just pretend these things don't matter. And so my position as a white American is simply when they say, well, who does the flag belong to? What should we think about white privilege? What should be our relationship to the United States? What should be, by which I mean, the government, the regime, broadly speaking, what should be our position to civic nationalism? My response is simply, look, none of these questions matter until white Americans have equality, until affirmative action is gone, until we are not treated as a hated class by our own government, until we are allowed to advance our own interests the same as any other group. And until those things happen, I believe we are in the position of the only legitimately aggrieved party, particularly when all these other groups that seem to be complaining, we're subsidizing them and we're paying for them. And absolutely. The fundamental lie, really, of American race relations in this country is about who needs whom. We don't need them. They need us. They need us to pay for everything. And for some reason, when we talk about, especially relevant, when we talk about independence, I just grow very weary of all the complaints and all the historical claims made when the last thing that they would want is any kind of separation from us because the whole racket would fall apart.
Absolutely. Totally. Let's bring in Millennial Woese. Woese, do you have any thoughts on this? Should white Americans basically just say, yeah, all right, all of our symbols, our institutions, they're all irredeemably racist. So what we want, we're going to take them and we're going to go. If you want your own flag, how about your own country along with that? Do you have some thoughts on this?
If that is possible, then yeah, they probably should do that. Because it is what makes sense. But the issue is how to do that without having power first. And so I think the issue is how to get the power so that you can do things like that. And that seems to be what, I mean, the path is obvious. What should happen is obvious. The issue is how to get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, though, that critical race theory and just wokeness and this latest wave of attacks on white America and white identity are actually extremely useful to white identitarians like me. It's forcing white Americans who want to think of themselves as generic human beings and America as a universal ideology that anybody can embrace to think of themselves in racialized terms, which I think is the first step towards actually becoming a a people again. Greg, what are your thoughts on that?
One of the fundamental tenets of critical race theory is that one of the benefits of whiteness is that you get to be the default identity. You get to pretend you don't have race. And I've never quite understood why that's a privilege or why that's something that we should be able to get away with somehow. After all, I'd say whites were better off when white identity was taken for granted and there was a shared sense of belonging and a shared sense of identity, certainly something all the founders felt. This idea that we are invisible, this idea that we're the default, I think is really just sort of a cope to try to come to terms with post-Civil Rights Act America, where white Americans and only white Americans basically took one quote out of context from a Martin Luther King speech and decided we're going to have a colorblind country defined by, I don't know, legal equality and good wishes or something like that. And maybe that could even work if you had the demographics of the 1960s in place forever. But as demographics continue to change, and as you have more and more programs going further, trying to achieve not just racial equality at this point, but of course what they call equity, equality of results, which is completely impossible. The longer this goes on, the more ambitious the programs get, and the more the demographics change, the more unsustainable the idea of a colorblind America becomes. Now, the question is, will we end up having a white identity that's purely negative and that people truly believe? In Germany, for example, I mean, there's a whole movement, you know, anti-Germany, where it's white Germans, but they will say, we need to destroy ourselves, we need to abolish ourselves, because what our ancestors created was something of unique evil. And we know from polls that white progressives are the only group in the world, as far as we can tell, that have a negative preference toward their own race, toward their own group. So there is a possibility where we are going to get a white consciousness that's purely negative, and the people who lack white consciousness will be the conservatives, and they'll be saying, no, we need to not have a racial identity. We need to fight for this common American identity, which nobody believes in except them. And it's shades of every single Republican political and cultural campaign where you constantly have them making the Democrats or the real racist argument, or removing Democrats from the Capitol and saying, this is actually a win for us because these guys were racist Democrats. They don't get any credit from the people they're trying to appeal to. They demoralize their own side. They buy into the preferences of critical race theory, and they just kind of keep losing in slow motion over and over and over again. So I agree that there's an opportunity here, but we have to be careful, because a lot of the way the opposition to critical race theory is being framed is, we need to oppose these things because this is actually a violation of the Civil Rights Act, or this is a violation of the colorblind spirit of America, or what Martin Luther King would have wanted, or something like that. And we have to be able to say, like, no, this is the logical conclusion. I mean, this is where these ideas ultimately lead. And if you're going to effectively combat these things, you need a positive version of white identity, something that historically all Americans understood. And if you don't have those things, as Woz said, I mean, we're all just kind of amusing ourselves with a talking shop. It's all abstract. It's really a question of, how do we get from here to there? And the first step is saying, we are an oppressed class. We are a people that is subjugated and occupied, and we have the right to resist and to have something of our own.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go through some of the questions that have showed up at Entropy now. So if you would like to leave a question, comment, and donation, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. I have a question here from Nils, and $50. Thank you very much. It's very generous. Here's July's donation. As always, given in the name of the great god, Ingmar Fryer. Also, since it seems to be fashionable to ask the panel about favorite whatnots, I am curious to know what the panel's favorite Faroese ballads are. Well, this would have worked, Nils, in any normal show, but Frody isn't on until the second hour today, so I'll just bring it up then. I don't think any of us who are currently on have any Faroese ballads that we can talk about, but we'll definitely take that up with Frody when he comes.
You would think I would, but I suppose not enough.
I remember going to this series of concerts at the Nordic Heritage Museum in Ballard, which is part of Seattle now. And it was great. And they had like chamber music from the court of Sweden, and they had Danish music and Norwegian music. It was classical music. And then the Iceland thing was basically a singer and a guy with a guitar, and they were singing these songs, and you know, they would explain what the song was about. And this is about Inga, and she got pregnant and she buried the child alive after her birth and then felt bad about it or something. And it's like, this is really dark and horrible stuff. So I don't know what Faroese ballads are like, but a lot of these folk songs from Iceland were quite dark. So Elizabeth writes in with $50 US, and she says, I am Anglo-Irish Canadian, and I am sickened by the blood libel of Indian mistreatment and the consequential cancellation and humiliation of heritage white Canadians. Can you comment? I assume she's referring to this latest hullabaloo about what Indian schools and there being like graves near them or something. As if these were like concentration camps or something like that.
Yeah, the argument isn't even really being made. It's just sort of inferred. There were these schools, we found these graves, therefore there was a deliberate attempt to exterminate these people. And it's, okay, one doesn't necessarily follow, but whatever you say. I mean, obviously you have the same kind of scandal, interestingly enough, in Ireland, where you had these sorts of graves founded, and nobody said, oh, obviously this was a campaign of racial extermination against the Irish by the church. There's just sort of this vague allegation of misdoing that we don't fully understand, and therefore we need to destroy these institutions today for some reason. It's just now, you know, you have a racial angle, so it becomes much more important to people. I think that one of the biggest takeaways that we need to have, and this is especially true of those of us in the Anglosphere, is the differences between Canadians and Americans and English and Australians. I mean, these are things that people just need to get past. At the end of the day, I have more in common with a white Canadian, with a white Englishman, with a white Australian than I do with a quote-unquote American who has the same passport as me. I don't even think that can be argued anymore. We have common interests. We have common foes. We have a common destiny. And so, I mean, one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about this July 4th is the old Grand Union flag, which was the first real flag of the United States, where you had the Union Jack in the corner. And I think of a line that was deleted from the Declaration of Independence, where Thomas Jefferson, who obviously had passionate interest in Saxon institutions and wrote a great deal about them, addresses the English people and said, we might have been a great and free people together, which I always thought was pretty tragic and sad in terms of like what could have been. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something we need to start thinking about again, in the sense that it's not really a question of, oh, save America. It's a question of saving Western civilization's posts on the North American continent and in Australia and around the world, because at the end of the day, we are a people, and maybe someday we should even be a polity or an empire unto ourselves, rather than trying to save governments who seem to be undermining their own foundations. Again, I think that's one of the things, as was pointed out, you know, for this just to avoid being theory, how do we talk about getting power? I mean, one of the things we have to look at is that I think these governments are really undermining their own foundations by so casually destroying the founding myths like that, because I don't know who they expect to fight for their empire and pay for everything if they're going to train entire generations of people to say that their countries are terrible.
Right. Absolutely. And I do hope that they are tested very, very soon. I would like to see the wheels come off this as quickly as possible. Woz, do you have any thoughts about this blood libel that's being spun out about Canadians and Indians and nuns?
It seems to be a really evil thing that's being done here, where, as Gregory said, it's done by implication. You know, the accusation is not actually formally made. It's just said. It's just hinted at. And then everyone gets the idea. Oh, my God, these kids were massacred. It seems on the face of it to be preposterous. You know, why would you set up a school only to massacre the pupils? Or even, I don't know, maybe the school was built and then later on this decision. I mean, I don't really know how exactly it would have played out. Would the kids have been killed
or died?
What on earth are they suggesting? As soon as you look at it, it just sounds ridiculous. But yeah. I think as... It's like Cheddar Man. It's not actually supposed to add up. It's not supposed to seem scientifically true or convincing. It's just supposed to sound true enough, or it's just supposed to do reputational damage and morale damage. And that's
absolutely.
And it will do that. And so job done. You know, it's a success. Doesn't matter that it's obviously untrue.
That you have hysterical women, you know, screaming as they tear down the statues of Canadian figures and everything else. I mean, we used to make jokes in this country about, well, who could be opposed to Canada? And you would even hear American liberals say, well, Canada doesn't have this same kind of history of exploitation and racism as America does, blah, 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 blah. Now, of course, they're putting everybody in the same boat and they're saying everything needs to be destroyed. And it's so artificial and so obviously conjured, but that doesn't mean that the people in these videos who are screaming and having mental breakdowns over these things they didn't know about until a month ago, they really do believe what they're saying. But what this proves is just the power of media to shape consciousness, to shape values, and to shape the emotional well-being of people.
The utter dishonesty and recklessness of this too.
Yeah. And You have to, the beginning of wisdom, I think, for our people has to be a certain kind of cynicism combined with a almost insane idealism, where the cynicism has to be that when you see a campaign like this appealing to you on moral grounds, you have to assume right off the bat that not only is this a lie, it's going to be a really obvious lie. And I almost don't even want to look into it just because it's going to fall apart so easily, as it always does, if I even do 5 seconds of actual research into this. And it's so cynical because the people who are saying this, I think, know it's a lie. But the people who are acting on it and the people who are holding the riots and the demonstrations, they really believe it. But I think what this really shows is that they would believe anything.
They believe anything.
Idealism needs to come from a vision where we say, we're going to get past this stuff because what we have in mind is an ideal of, you know, proud Anglosphere and more broadly Western civilization that's not going to be held back by blood libels deliberately created by people who hate us to harm us. We're not going to treat this in good faith.
Who can we find the names of the people who initiate these lies and hold them accountable? That would be nice. Surely there's somebody who initiated this lie. It's a conscious lie. There are people sitting in newsrooms talking about how the world needs to hear about this, who are consciously shading facts. They're creating a lie. It would be nice to hold these people accountable. Eventually, we're going to have to treat the established media like Henry VIII treated the Catholic Church. It's just going to have to be disestablished. The institutions are going to have to be expropriated. The people who work in them are going to have to be pauperized, or let's just give them an early retirement. We don't have to be mean about it. The power that they have, institutional power, has to be broken. They simply, these people exercise enormous power with zero accountability. That has to end. It cannot, no responsible opposition can countenance that this institution of the mass media, the lying press, can exist without any accountability. They have power without accountability. That's tyranny.
Yeah, I would say that they are far more, a typical journalist has a far greater claim to be treated as a public official than does an actual politician. I mean, a politician under the system has very little power. I think if the last few years have shown us anything, it's that they're not the ones who really run the show, that even if you elect someone, they won't necessarily have control over the bureaucracy or even their own staff, who, of course, will go running to the media to create narratives, to create leaks about things that may or may not be true. I mean, ultimately, whoever owns the media, whoever finances these things, whoever comes up with the theories and the justifications in the universities, at the end of the day, it's the media that's the center of power. And so our attitude toward them should be our attitude towards the people who are actually considered sovereign. You know, who's president of the United States is less important to me than who controls the New York Times, who controls the Washington Post, and what agenda these guys are pushing. And I think they should be held accountable through the state even more directly than a congressman, because at the end of the day, these congressmen don't count for very much.
They have,
and
they
as far
have
as the arguments of, right. And as far as the arguments of free speech and as far as the arguments of when we need rational discussion and everything else, well, if the last few years have taught us anything, it's that the number one enemy of freedom of speech is the mainstream media.
And rational discussion.
Yeah. I mean, let's be blunt about this. I mean, every journalist laid off, every newspaper shuttered, every media conglomerate that goes bankrupt is a victory for humanity as a whole. And we are more knowledgeable without them. We would have more freedom of speech if we had fewer journalists. We would be more informed if we had fewer newspapers. We would have more rational discussion if we had fewer media conglomerates.
Absolutely.
Now, people can complain about this, but I think the attitude toward journalists should be that they are a class unto themselves with a certain amount of political power that is unique to their class, and they should be treated as a class. I mean, there are some people who have a general oppositional attitude towards police officers as such. I would say that, you know, those are just guys doing their job. I think that attitude is much more justified if it's being directed at journalists as such.
You know, absolutely. But
I mean, does he, this is one of the things, the word journalist, for example, you go online, I mean, all of these people will say, well, he's not a real journalist.
Yeah.
And they'll get attacked and other reporters will cheer them on and everything else. And you'll sort of see this response of people saying, well, no, he's doing real journalism. Real journalism is exposing the facts. There's nothing particularly amazing, except for courage, I guess, in going out there and just accurately finding out what's happening. And with webcams and the ability to live stream and everything else, we really don't need photographers and correspondents and the type of celebrity journalists who would go to dangerous areas and bring us back the true story. At this point, anyone can do that, and anyone can usually do a better job. And what journalists, and again, it goes back to what we were saying about Noam White's and the American flag. I'd say this is true of journalists today in regard to how they approach freedom of speech. What they're saying is not, we are doing a better job in presenting the truth to you than anyone else. What they're saying is, we and we alone have the right to determine who gets to express themselves on these platforms. We are the ones who get to determine what is and what is not misinformation. Now, misinformation, quote unquote, is being treated as a kind of threat to the security of the state and whether this country will survive foreign enemies. I mean, pretty scary implications if you follow where this line of thought goes. And journalists themselves are arguing essentially that they are a class that have special rights and special privileges and a special responsibility in determining who does and does not get to enjoy the First Amendment. And so, as with blacks in the American flag, with journalists, I say we take them at their word. You know, they're not like us. They're not typical people who enjoy the First Amendment. They're a class unto themselves, and they should be treated as foreigners, essentially.
Well, I think that they should at least be subject to some form of impeachment. For instance, if they lie, shouldn't we have...
You could have plenty of practical things. I mean, lawyers, for example, have a code of conduct where you're disbarred if you engage in certain things.
Yeah.
Now, if you had a code of a guild or something along those lines where a journalist is expected to have certain standards of behavior, and if they knowingly lie, for example, they can't do X, Y, and Z, that would be something that could be easily done. You have to ask yourselves, why would they be so opposed to such a thing, given that there are already professions in this country that operate under a code of conduct?
Yeah, Absolutely. What are your thoughts on the journalist question, on the lying press question?
I live in Britain, so, you know.
You live under another form of tyranny, so you have to be careful about what you say, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking while you were speaking, you know, if I were at a house party and met someone and they said that they were a journalist, like for BuzzFeed or something, how would I react? You know, because obviously the temptation would be to just have contempt for them and walk away. I do agree that they do have the real power in our society. It is the media who decide basically the narrative on everything and what most people will believe about most issues. I think they are the real power. And so the question then is the real power is not going to just let you, it's not going to agree to reduce its own potency in society. So how do we get it under control? And you know, that's probably going to be a question for this century. Because it is totally corrupt. And I think we've seen that over the last 5 years, especially the last year. It's just like with the US election, BLM, it's just staggering. Their capacity and ability to lie, their willingness to lie, and how easily they can make people believe things. It's staggering. So, yeah, I don't really know what else to say. I think that ideally we would start our own, other people would start their own media companies, which would aggregate and become competitors. But that's much, much more easily said than done. But I think it probably will have to happen.
We've learned over the last few years that, this is what they teach you in conservatism 101, right? When I was a 21-year-old politico and they send you to all the schools and learn the basics of your ideology, this is how it goes. Oh, there's a free marketplace of ideas. And the great thing about capitalism is people get to choose what they want. And that's how you maximize.
They don't consumer. Even know yeah. what they want.
And it's like, well, yeah. I mean, there's two fundamental questions here. One, as you say, the people who control value, what constitutes value, what constitutes what people want, what people desire, they're the ones who have real power. And two, even if we concede that some people at least are capable of making judgments about what they want, if the last couple of years have shown us anything, it's that if we have a free marketplace of ideas, if such a thing has ever really existed, people come to our side. So what do? They shut it down. They make sure you can't do financial transactions. They boot you off the platforms. They run hate campaigns against this person or that person to get them depersoned, essentially, and taken away from institutions that everyone else in society can take for granted. And so it's especially ironic when the media is the one constantly warning about authoritarianism, but we already live under an authoritarian government. We're already experiencing authoritarianism. I'd argue it's a lot worse in Britain than it is here, but not by much. The only difference between a government like ours and a government like China's is that the authoritarian tools used by the state here are used to actually, and I would argue knowingly, make the country worse. Whereas I think in China, you might have rulers that are ruthless, but sincerely want to make their country better and stronger. Whereas I think our leaders want to make our country worse and just
yeah.
This, to quote something Greg said, I guess last year, 2020 was the year America died. And I can't come up with this, but one of the sayings I've been seeing floating around is that America is a corpse and Republicans are cheering for the corpse and the Democrats are cheering for the maggots. And that's a way of putting it, but that's where we are. Now, again, we have theoretically, I think there's a path forward. I'm working on a book a little bit about the theory of what's happening and trying to get it through the minds of American conservatives about what's happened to what used to be their country. And that's important. We can't really do anything until at least we have a critical mass of people who truly understand that. But in practical terms, as Woz said, we can't just talk ourselves in circles about the way things should be or what we'll do if we have power, this, that, and the other thing. We have to talk about how we're actually going to get there. And step one, I think, ultimately has to be physical concentration to take advantage of what tools the political system still has in terms of having some sort of representation, because we have seen cases where political power has managed to triumph over media campaigns of, you know, hatred and blood libels against white America. And secondly, and probably most importantly, is, I mean, entropy is a start, but we have to figure out other ways of raising money and being able to sustain ourselves and building networks that are anti-fragile and not subject to media attack. Now, I think that's already being done to some extent simply because the media is forcing us to do the things that we should have been doing 5 years ago, and frankly, would never have done had we not been forced to it. So, I mean, there are signs of hope out there. And, you know, I hate to sound like a shill, but the fact is we already have the numbers. I mean, if you look at the data in terms of, even if you take the most unflattering description of the quote unquote alt-right or whatever term they want to use, even if you word the language to make us look as bad as possible, you're still talking about millions and millions and millions of people who support us and say they support us. And if all those people sent like a dollar a month, I mean, we would have won by now.
Oh, yeah, it is frustrating. One thing that I'd say just before Greg's going to intervene, I think in America, the thing you should be doing just now is trying to secure the First Amendment, because even if it will stay in law, I think in practice it is greatly damaged. Because what's the point of using your freedom of speech if doing so ruins your life? In that case, you don't really have freedom of speech. And I think the media are, I mean, they do ruin your life if you say something unfashionable. I mean, it's really staggering how vicious they are with people. And the other thing related to this is about lawfare on social media. The argument seems to be the US government can't force social media platforms to abide by the First Amendment, because to do so would violate those corporations' First Amendment rights. And I think that's just
corporations
insane.
Don't have First Amendment rights.
Well, one way or the other, it's just crazy to force Twitter or Facebook or YouTube to abide by the First Amendment would be to violate their First Amendment right. You're forcing them to platform people who they don't want to platform. Right. But at this point, it's a public utility. So it's that argument could be brought in as well. That seems to me like that should be a priority.
Absolutely.
It should be. And theoretically, you know, even issues of, oh, freedom of association and you should be able to serve who you want, blah, blah, blah. It's like, all right, well, since the Civil Rights Act, I mean, that's all a moot point. And that doesn't mean anything. Even bringing up these sorts of things is like saying, well, according to the Holy Roman Empire, like you're not allowed to do. I mean, it's totally irrelevant. This whole legal framework has already been destroyed. And so it can't really be used in good faith. And again, I think the people who are using it know this. Now, some people on the right, some people on the mainstream American right have said, look, under the Civil Rights Act, these things should be treated as utilities. They should be treated as common carriers. We have a legal framework in place to say we want access on these platforms. But here we get into the problem, which is that the American conservative movement benefits from what's happening. The big story of 2015 was that was the year Conservatism Inc. learned that they had no connection to their own base, where they more or less unanimously lined up against then candidate Donald Trump and said, do not vote for this guy under any circumstances. Do not support him in a primary. And if he becomes the nominee, then we want no part of the conservative movement. And grassroots conservatives said, well, we're still going to vote for him anyway. And I think a lot of conservative leaders, rather than learning from this experience and saying, well, maybe we should rethink some of our beliefs or rethink how we can rebuild credibility with our own base, said, well, the way we do this is by essentially leaning into censorship, by making sure that the people who can threaten our hold on the masses are deplatformed. So, for example, one of the things that you'll see from progressives when they complain, when they'll say like, oh, well, there actually is no left-wing bias on social media. And the proof is that if you look at the people who have the greatest engagement on things like Facebook, it's like Franklin Graham and Ben Shapiro and people like that. And it's, well, yeah, that's because there's a certain desire for opposition to what's going on, but you've also set up this fake opposition that you permit to exist. And so people will go to that because that's the only thing that's available. So both the people who run the American conservative movement, they're going to lose, but they don't really care because they're going to have their platform. They're going to have their jobs. They're going to have whatever little network they've got. They're going to be permitted to have these things because they serve a role. And I think progressives, the smarter ones anyway, are also satisfied with this because they know that they have an opposition that's incapable of fundamentally challenging them. Whereas 5 years ago, they faced an opposition that could fundamentally challenge them. So for this reason, I don't think you're ever going to see Republicans do what they could do to demand access on big tech platforms. Right now, even in Congress, there's a bit of a show with Kevin McCarthy and people like that saying, oh, they're going to hold big tech accountable. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. Well, they could have done all this when they had the majority and they didn't do it. And they're not going to do it now. I mean, what they really want essentially is to convince enough of their base that they're going along with some fight against big tech and standing up for their First Amendment principles and First Amendment rights, but they don't actually want to use state power to protect those rights. Because if they did that, they would sort of undermine their own power. If you have an authentic nationalist American right in this country, what use does anybody have for Conservatism Inc.? So, I mean, this again gets back to the practical question, which is, if we're going to get these things, if we're going to get these fundamental rights respected, we're not going to get them through the Republican Party, because I think the Republican Party is going to fight to the bitter end to make sure these things don't happen. That doesn't mean there won't be exceptions. That doesn't mean this congressman or that congressman might not do something about it. But, you know, National Review, the Heritage Foundation, all these groups, they have nothing to gain from free speech online. If American conservatives were allowed to say what they really wanted, they wouldn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that we are making inroads, though. I think the first thing that we have to do is not build new payment processors and geographically concentrate, although those are important things. The first thing we just have to do, and it's something that we can do today with our own power, is change more minds, get more people on our side. The establishment, the neoliberal set of preferences that always seems to win out, actually represents the preferences of, what, less than 10% of the population? Yet they made a science of not giving the people what they want. And the more people we can unplug and wise up, red pill, and get on our sides, get them to see through the sham of the two-party system as it's constituted today, that's how we win. We get more people on our side and fewer people on their side. Now, of course, raw numbers have to add up to power eventually, but certainly the more people we have and the more people we have working on that problem, the better. And we can begin today.
One thing I want to push back on a little bit with that, though, is even within your own argument just now, I mean, you basically said, well, the people are already on our side. You know, the people who are pushing these things, the most extreme left-wing agendas, even something like, you know, okay, you can't, now it's a problem if you fly an American flag or something like that. Like, these people are in the minority. It's not a question of winning over the majority of people to our side. We already have that. Now, I think the majority of people are clearly not going to identify as white advocates. The majority of people are not going to go along with some program where they say, actually, you know, critical race theory is an outgrowth of the Civil Rights Act, therefore we need to get rid of the Civil Rights Act. That's going to be a bit much for most people. But if you say, okay, these are the salient issues right now, do you support or oppose this specific thing that's happening right now? Most people are going to be on our side, at least most white people. But that agreement means nothing if it doesn't lead to action. And so I guess what I would say is the bigger focus is not so much changing minds as getting the people who already agree with us to some extent to do something effective to make sure their energy isn't transferred into unproductive directions, as we saw at the Tea Party. I mean, remember that? I mean, I can
tell
you in real time how that happened, where you had a grassroots movement that was unexpected from the American right pop up, and you literally had people having meetings basically saying, you know, how can we get these guys to go nuts about tax cuts for billionaires as opposed to doing anything productive? We're going to still face that problem now. And the third thing, of course, is there has to be a practical goal that will inspire people to action, but it can't be so practical that it's uninspiring. It has to be something that's idealistic, almost unrealistic, a Sorelian vision, where a myth, where you're basically saying, this is what we're doing. We're engaged in the quest for national redemption. This is what we're a part of. This is why you need to join us, and you need to do it right now. Because, I mean, if we got even 10% more of the American people with us, I just don't think it would make a difference if we still see the same proportion of committed activists or committed donors or committed supporters that we have now. We really need the people who are already with us to do something productive. And maybe that's on us to basically say, like, this is specifically what you need to do, or what I think would be a good idea to do. And it can't just be donate money. You know, I mean, yes, that's part of it. But, like, I feel like an idiot when people ask questions like, well, what can I do? And I say, well, donate money. And it's like, well, okay, but that's not the most inspiring thing to tell people.
It's not the most inspiring thing, but a lot of people won't do anything else anyway. And look, 25% of the people who are listening to us today have been red-pilled since 2018. Yeah. That's astonishing. That's a huge amount of growth that's gone on. I know it's happened at Amren. It's happened with Countercurrents. We've had a lot of growth since the alt-right fell apart. What do we give these people to do now that they don't have any fearless leaders and marches and stuff like that to get excited about or lose their jobs over? I just say, well, get them to donate. They can at least do that in the privacy of their own homes while we work on expanding their comfort zone. But we just need to stay. We need to stay online. We need to stay active and, you know, fight back against all this deplatforming. And that's why donations are important. Greg, we're running out of time. So I want to ask you this. Miko has written in.
Mm-hmm.
And his question is this. Let me just read this. I think you can provide some perspective on this. Why is there such a feeling of malaise and disengagement in the movement today? I know a lot of people out there in radio land and live stream land feel this. I've answered this question recently myself. A lot of people are feeling this, but what are your thoughts on this question? And then we'll go to Woes.
I think that's an excellent question, and I want to thank Miko for asking it. My response is that there are two movements. One is the movement that is being put forward online. That's our public face to the world. And that is, as you say, it's focused on staying online, which takes a lot of energy, getting enough money to pay the bills, keeping the power on, so to speak. And that can seem a bit, I don't want to say apathetic or that there's a feeling of malaise, but I mean, there is something decidedly uninspiring of just doing enough to keep going. It's obviously necessary. It's obviously you have to do these things. Can't save the world if you can't pay the rent. But I get why people would think to themselves, oh, well, all right, these guys are just doing their thing, but there's no forward momentum. But the second thing is much more interesting, and I would argue where the real energy is right now, and that's not happening online. And this is what I would say to people in terms of what can I do? And this isn't, you know, send us $5 or something like that. It's people are forming groups in the real world right now, networks of people who can take care of each other economically, who are moving to the same area, who are building common skills, who are buying property, who are living in the same region, who are building networks, tribes, churches, whatever you want to call them, fraternities, mannerbunds, all of these things. And there's no one group and there's no one model that's working for everyone because people are different. But I'm seeing these things spring up at a blistering pace all around the country. And it's something that it almost can't be discussed online, not just because, you know, oh, tactically it might not be the greatest idea, but it just wouldn't make sense to discuss online. You can't explain it. It's something that has to be experienced. And it's also something that, you know, unless you're in it, you're never going to get it. What is the term, you know, for those outside the myth, no explanation will suffice. For those inside the myth, no explanation is necessary. And ordinary people are doing this because, as you say, Greg, and this is especially important, people are coming in after Charlottesville. People are coming in after January 6th. People are coming in when they know the stakes are high, when they know they're facing losing their jobs, when they know they're facing the possibility of political violence or political repression, and yet they're still doing stuff. And so if people say, well, there's a malaise at the national level, there's a malaise online because, you know, a YouTube channel that I used to see that got millions of views isn't there anymore, I feel you. And I'm not trying to say, no, actually, everything's fine. There are unique challenges right now, and there are problems that we are facing. But the best thing that you can do right now is not to look for so-called leaders for your salvation. Leaders will emerge. Leaders will just emerge from the struggle. The way that we're going to get those people is by building these kinds of networks in your community right now. And that's something every single person who is listening to me right now should be doing with their friends and with people they agree with. And frankly, if you don't have friends in the area who are willing to do this, move, because it is going to take something like that. It is going to take actually getting together in the real world to build these things. And these are also things that are not political per se. I mean, there's no media hit piece that can be written about them. There's no campaign to deplatform. It's not even something that needs a name or needs a structure. In fact, in some ways, it might be better if you don't have these things. And what I'm seeing happen all around the country spontaneously, and as far as I can tell, with no real single leadership or group or person behind it, but just sort of like a vast unconscious force. That's why I'm more optimistic now than I was in 2015 or even after President Trump's election.
So Nico, that is great. That is well said.
I hope that, you know, gives you some fire in your heart and some enthusiasm in your spirit, because look, it really sucks sometimes when you're reading the headlines and you think to yourself, you know, of all the times I was born in history, why was I born now? When all the things that I value and all the things that were taken for granted for most of human history are now spat upon. I would be so much happier if I was born 100 years ago or maybe 100 years from now and everything else. The best way to look at these things I've found is simply to rejoice that you're alive at the most important time in human history. You're at the time that is the crucible for Western civilization. And you have an incredible opportunity, and you've got a lot you can do with the resources at your command right now. Not just modestly supporting the public faces that you think are worthy of that support, but also by creating a power base with the people that you know right now. And strong tribes defeat a weak empire, and tribes are forming all around this country. And eventually, if we have enough of those people, I see that as a nucleus of a new people in and of themselves. And so that's already happening. And so it's just a question of finding out where it's happening, finding out the forum that speaks to you the most, and then becoming a part of it.
That's really well said. I wrote a piece called The State of the Movement, which I just linked in the chat. The point that I made is that the people who measure the movement by the number of talking heads on stage are seeing those talking heads disappear, and they think the movement is shrinking. The ones like you and me who are on stage and looking out at the audience, we have access to the traffic statistics and things like that. We see the audience growing, and we also know about things IRL that are happening that are very, very encouraging. So folks, there may be fewer YouTubers out there, but there are more real world things happening, and that's really very, very important. And there are more people seeking answers than ever before, so yeah. Don't despair.
Yeah, one thing, I know we got to go, but one thing I want to say, and Greg, you bring this up a lot, And this is very, very important for everybody out there to get. It's not hypothetical or a guess or a desire when we say, you know, look, more people are paying attention to us now and reading this stuff than ever before. That's a fact. because we can see the numbers. We know how many people are coming to these sites. We know how many people are seeking out this information. Greg, it seems every month you at Countercurrents are publishing a new record in terms of how many people are accessing the site. And this is after deplatforming. This is after the demonization campaigns. This is after all the extreme technical difficulties that we have to go through just to stay online. And yet more people are coming to this thing than ever before. So what does that tell you about the strength of the movement? There are more people than ever before. They're willing to do more than ever before. And they understand the stakes better than ever before. So the potential is all there. It's just a question of at some point, someone's going to set, you know, it's just going to catch. And I don't think that it's something that needs to be planned for, or where some guy, you know, puts himself at the head of the parade and says, everyone follow me, we're going to do this. As if like one giant organism in and of itself. I think this thing is building towards something great. And when the moment comes, people will know what to do.
Absolutely.
So be optimistic.
Yeah. So Woz, what are your thoughts on this, this idea that there's a malaise? Do you think there is a malaise in the movement?
Yes, I do. I think that certainly in the British context, there's a malaise compared to 18 months ago or a year ago. So I think that that more broadly, I think that internationally, there is not the same sense of that we had in 2016, the sense that we could just do things without there being quite serious repercussions on our lives. And I think for a lot of people, including me, the seriousness of those repercussions has become much more clear since then. We knew it was dangerous, but we didn't realize how dangerous it was going to be. So, or at any rate, it has become more dangerous. I mean, the powers that be have become much better at detecting people and, you know, wrecking their lives. So that's a real thing. And I think that, and also the deplatforming online, I think has also had a huge effect. And of course it would have. I mean, there's no way that it would not have a huge effect. But I also think that there is the growth of alt tech, and there is also the growth in of real life organizations and, you know, fraternities, things that are quite organic. So I don't think there's a cause for despair, but I think I wouldn't blame anyone for wondering, for noticing a lack of direction in the movement just now.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's really well said. We are past the 1 hour mark. So thank you. I have to say goodnight. Woz is bowing out at this time. And I want to thank also Gregory Hood for coming on. Greg, thank you so much. How do people follow your work?
Well, I'm over at Amren, and I'm on Gab as Greg Hood. I'm also on Twitter as I think it's Vidair James K. And you can get a hold of me through various platforms there. And the email address that's posted on New Century Foundation website. As far as, you know, direction and everything else, I did want to say right now I'm working on a book called Nationalist Without a Nation, which I'm going to try to be my, that's going to be my response as far as, you know, what I think the direction should be, where we're going from here. And I guess I just want to close by saying, Greg, it was a real honor to be on, and Woz, you know, good to be on with you. Let's stay in touch. I've talked to you in forever, so glad to hear your voice.
I think this is the first time you and I have ever spoken, so yeah, it was nice.